Over on patreon.com, we have got a lot of new exclusive Bowery Boys audio for our super fans, including, of course, our regular Patreon-only show called Side Streets.
And at the $5.5 level and above, I've got a whole episode of bonus scenes from my recent Stories of Flushing show with many more interesting bits of history. Then at the $10 Gilded Age level, you'll get audio from my interview with author Eric J. Dolan, recorded at the New York Historical Society. We're talking privateers, pirates, and the American Revolution.
And that's not all. At that same level, you also get exclusive merchandise, new shows a couple of days before everybody else, and you get all of our podcasts ad-free.
You won't even hear this message. That's all on patreon.com/Bowery Boys.
Your support helps us keep the show running. Thank you so much.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Ed Dias was a smart, talented, athletic kid from Texas who had a passion for flying, movie star good looks, and a flair for acting. Thanks to a chance encounter on a highway in the middle of nowhere, he went on to become an ace fighter pilot, lead men with guns ablazing in America's first amphibious attack during World War II, survive the Bataan Death March, and escape a harsh Japanese POW camp. All the while, Dias kept quietly inspiring and leading everyone he encountered. Today on the show, I discuss this real-life G.I. Joe with writer and filmmaker John Lucas. John is the author of Escape from Davo, and he made a documentary about Dias called 4443, narrated by A1 podcast guest Dale Dye. John shares how Dias started his military career as a fighter pilot during World War II, but ended up leading men on the ground in the earliest infantry battles in the Pacific. We then dig into Dias' experience during the Bataan Death March and how he continued to support his men during the Crucible. John then shares how Dias, along with 9 other men, escaped from one of Japan's harshest prison camps and how he fought his way out of the jungle to let his government know of the atrocities going on in the Philippines. We end our conversation with a discussion of why Ed didn't win the Medal of Honor, despite his heroic actions, his tragic death, and the leadership lessons we can all take from him. After the show's over, check out the show notes at aom.is/Dyess. That's D-Y-E-S-S. John Lucas, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So you reached out to me after, I think we did the podcast about The Liberator, right? The guy.
Correct. Alex Kershaw's book.
Yeah, Alex Kershaw's book. Incredible story, just following the 45th Infantry all the way from Italy to Germany. You reached out to me and said, hey, I've got another story that a lot of people don't know about. And the guy's incredible. His name's Ed Dies. Before we get into the details, how did you discover this story of Ed Dies? And why do so few people know about him?
Well, Brett, it's an excellent way to start off. Very few people know about Ed Dies just because Battle of Bataan, you know, it was the darkest, earliest days of World War II. It was a loss. I think, you mentioned Alex's book, you know, and Felix Sparks. We tend to dwell on the victories, you know, in terms of military history, especially, you know, in the U.S. I think it is a, you know, I don't know if it's a, an ego thing, definitely, you know, we don't want to talk about when things went wrong. That was a situation where things went very wrong. So I think that his story has been, you know, as he was a big part of that battle, it was the largest surrender in U.S. military history. And that's probably the reason why we haven't heard that much about it.
Right. But, you know, despite losing that, he did some incredible stuff. We're going to get into what he did because he is like a real life G.I. Joe. But before there, let's get to his background. Where was Ed from? Where was he raised? And he started off as a pilot. So did he have an interest in aviation even as a young man?
Yes, that's a great line to call him G.I. Joe. I've used Captain America quite a lot, and they're both interchangeable. He is almost a superhero type figure, and it's strange. Sort of, I actually go back to your previous question. Now, I was researching this story about this escape from a Japanese prison camp. It was the only large-scale POW escape of the Pacific War. Obviously, Colonel Dias participated in that. He was, a prime mover in that story. But it was through the course of researching that escape story that I got into the Battle of Bataan in Corregidor, again, the early part of the war in the Philippines, and Dias' name popped up everywhere. So this is, you know, long before he became a prisoner of war, before the Bataan Death March, he was basically G.I. Joeing it around in the Philippines, in the air, on the ground, and doing everything he possibly could.
So yeah, I mean, as a young man, he was kind of exceptional even as a young man. He showed a lot of leadership potential. I mean, he's kind of Mr. All-American even as a teenager, right?
Yes. I mean, you know, he's, you know, to go get into his background, growing up in Texas, a small town called Albany, and basically it was the frontier. He was born in 1916, and, you know, it was the kind of town where residents at this time, they remember Billy the Kid, Wyatt Earp coming through there. There's a lot going on in the country at this time, and, you know, in terms of progress moving forward, the new frontier was the sky. It was airplanes, the aviation boom post-World War One into the 20s. And that's, you know, he got hooked. There were a bunch of guys, you know, barnstorming pilots, World War One guys that would, you know, land in these small towns out in the, you know, middle of Texas, Midwest. They'd try to make a few bucks by taking up townspeople for airplane rides. And Ed Dias, he got his first ride at the age of four, and he was hooked ever since.
And he like saved up for money, like, you know, did odd jobs so he could take pilot lessons, even as, like, I think he was like a teenager when that happened.
Right. Yeah. He worked several odd jobs in order to be able to take flying lessons. And I think it was, you know, it was one of those things where I guess for a boy or something back then, I'm sure, you know, sports were, you know, a big deal. But I think a lot of these guys, they looked up to pilots and things who were doing these, you know, extraordinary technological feats. He was into Charles Lindbergh, I guess, instead of, you know, Babe Ruth. But he was very resourceful. And again, keep in mind, this is, you know, the Great Depression. Nobody was sitting around, you know, watching TV or playing on the internet, or, you know, no cell phones, you know, like that. So he was out and about. He was busy working and, you know, like I said, doing odd jobs and, you know, multiple things in order to indulge his love of flying, but also to sort of, you know, further his education.
Did he sign up to be a Army pilot right out of high school, or did he have other plans and then got diverted there?
No, you know what? He was kind of, you know, a jack of all trades in high school, class president. Obviously, you know, his leadership skills, you know, were evident from an early age. He was really into acting. He had a dramatic flair, and he was great at sports, kept the flying thing on the down low. I don't think his mother wasn't very, very keen into it. So I think the flying lessons were very secret, and he ended up going away to school, a place called John Tarleton Agricultural College, now Tarleton State in Stephenville, Texas, about an hour away from Albany, outside of Abilene, where the Air Force Base is named for him. Graduated from there, again, did all the same things in high school, kind of, you know, was big man on campus. And then when he graduated, he was also an ROTC. That was a high school and college thing. So, you know, he had that, I guess, early military tendencies as well. But, you know, it's a great story. He was hitchhiking to the University of Texas in Austin. After he, you know, got his undergraduate degree, he was going to go to law school. His father was a judge. He never got to Austin, though. He ended up being picked up by a flyer, a guy who had washed out of the Randolph and Kelly Field training program, which was called the West Point of the Air at the time, before we had an Air Force Academy. So he never made it to Austin. He literally and figuratively did a U-turn with his life and went back and told his father. He said that, you know, I want to be a pilot, and I want to fly the fastest aircraft around. And there was only one way to do that at the time, and that was the United States military.
So how did he fare early in his military career? This was before World War II started, I assume, that he
correct.
Joined
this
up.
Was right, the mid to late 1930s. Once he was accepted into the flight training program, you know, the West Point of the Air, and it was just, you know, a perfect fit. Basically went to the head of the class in terms of leadership, flying skills, and everything that was needed, and kind of made his way up, you know, through the ranks, and then became the country's youngest squadron commander in 1940.
And where was he stationed, you know, when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor? Did he have a role in Pearl Harbor at all?
No, actually he was in the Philippines, and he left the U.S. He deployed in November 1941. He arrived in Manila Thanksgiving Day, 1941, which was about 2 weeks before the attack on Pearl Harbor. And so he was already there. He was, you know, at the tip of the spear, I guess you could say, in terms of, you know, our most far-flung outpost in the Pacific, the Philippines. And, you know, it's interesting because Pearl Harbor really gets, you know, all the attention December 7th, 1941, but December 8th was the date in the Philippines due to the, you know, the international dateline factor. The Japanese, you know, they hit Pearl Harbor once and they hit them pretty hard, but they hit the Philippines December 8th And the difference between, you know, the famous Day of Infamy in Pearl Harbor, they kept coming back to the Philippines and kept leveling our forces there, you know, throughout December. So Dias was, you know, he was in the thick of it from day one.
Yeah, and he shot down several planes, I think, in those skirmishes.
Yes, he shot down reportedly six planes, which would qualify him as an ace. You need five enemy planes to qualify as an ace. He shot up a Japanese truck convoy. Unfortunately, though, with the loss of records, and this was an early part of the war, again, there were no gun cameras on the fighter planes, P-40 Warhawks at the time. You know, but that was kind of the least of his worries was at the time was, you know, being able to get credit for shooting down the planes. Would have been nice, but you know, there were a lot of other things going on. Shortage of food, shortage of ammunition. Wasn't enough oxygen for the high altitude compressors. So these guys, you know, they couldn't really get in any high altitude dogfights. So there was you know, he was making do with what he had, but again, you know, the way that guy operated, he functioned spectacularly, you know, with very limited resources.
How old was he at this time?
He started out, when the war started, he was 25.
Okay, so he's 25. So, you know, about mid-20s, but still pretty young, right? I think It's funny, sometimes whenever I tend to do this, when I think back to like World War II vets, I'm like, oh yeah, they were like in their 30s, but like these guys, like someone like 19, 20, 21, like flying big beef, you know, bombers and fighter jets. Like these were really young guys.
Exactly. And that's something that I've always, you know, found as amazing, you know, it's strange. I think we do have a tendency, you know, when you're studying history, especially, you know, you think back at the Revolutionary War, you know, and you think of those guys as just being a bunch of old timers, you know, and with the exception of Ben Franklin, they were all in their 20s. And I think Washington was, you know, in his low 30s, you know, so these guys were all very young. And you know, it was similarly with World War II. You know, these guys are put on the front lines right off the bat. You know, and again, as you know, he was in the service, you know, before the war. Obviously, wasn't a part of the draft. He wasn't. You know, he was in it from day one. So he was one of those guys that was kind of learning as he went. You know, as a young guy, you know, and starting out as an amateur commander,
right,
and literally becoming a professional in a matter of weeks.
All right. So here's Dias. He's beginning of the war, basically an ace. Because he shot, you know, shooting down Japanese Zeros. But suddenly, like he has to become an infantryman. So he goes from fighter pilot to, you know, basically a grunt on the ground. Like, how did that happen? Why did he have to go from being a pilot to an infantryman?
It was a really unfortunate turn of events. You know, the famous line that Dias uttered, you know, he joined the military to fly planes. He wanted to be, you know, fighting a war in a cockpit. Not the jungle, was out on patrol as an infantryman, and was overheard to remark to one of his troops that he'd rather be back home in Texas, staring at the southbound end of a northbound mule. He was, you know, he wasn't happy with the situation, but again, the exigencies of the situation, the Japanese had a blockade on the main Pacific battle fleet was basically demolished. We lucked out that they didn't hit any of the carriers of Pearl Harbor, but we couldn't muster force for any convoys. We couldn't relieve the Philippines. We couldn't get reinforcements, supplies. After a while, you know, attrition basically took care of our small air force in the Philippines at the time. And so Dias was taken out of the cockpit, handed a rifle, and sent into the jungle.
Yeah. And I think, you know, part of the problem too, we talked about this we did a podcast about Lucky 666. Mm-hmm. You know, at the time, at the beginning of the war, the strategy for the Allies was Europe first, right? So like most of the resources were going to Europe and, you know, the guys in the Pacific weren't really getting that much.
Exactly. You nailed it. You know, and to be perfectly honest, I think, you know, to go back to even the first question, why have we not heard of Ed Dias? Why isn't this story, you know, gotten more attention is I think there still is a Europe first mentality. I think I don't know the exact numbers, but if you look at, you know, publishing houses, you know, Hollywood, European movies, European theater stories are predominant. And I think that that's just partially a factor of most people have some type of historical or hereditary ties to Europe, to the continent. And it was just a more, you know, a romantic type war. You know, you're basically dealing with a bunch of, you know, natives don't speak English. There's no big cities. There's nothing that geographically or you know, historically connects anybody to all these little islands and atolls, basically out in the middle of nowhere. And so, yes, I mean, he was he was suffering from, the Europe First strategy, where, the lion's share of the United States and as the arsenal of democracy was sending around the world, the Philippines got very little of it. And that's a great tragedy, in my opinion, is, the decision was made, obviously a strategic one, that, we would be basically supporting the war efforts of almost every other country, Great Britain, Soviet Union, but yet our own guys were left out.
Right. But so, yeah. So Ed didn't like the situation, but he still made the best of it. Like, what did he do to overcome this challenge, especially the challenge of leading men who are probably demoralized because of the situation?
Right. And it's, again, he was fortunate in having these very special, this innate talent for leadership. But the men under his command, they weren't really digging the new roles either. And keep in mind, it's a lot different than, current military training where, almost everybody has some type of, has to qualify for marksmanship or, knows how to pitch a tent or, spend the night out in the field somewhere, use a compass, go on long hikes, endurance, stamina, that type of thing. Back then, the military training was a lot different. If you went in the Air Force, you're going to be a pilot. You spent your time around planes. You were going to be a mechanic. You were taking apart engines. And so these guys had no idea how to be basic field soldiers. That was just, a product of the era. But Dias, thankfully, through his background, his upbringing, growing up again, kind of on the frontier in Texas, he knew how to ride a horse. He was handy with firearms. And so he was able to sort of transmit that knowledge through his leadership skills, through the first force of his personality, basically, to sort of serve as, a commanding officer, but also a drill sergeant, also a weapons expert, communicate everything he knew to his men. And I think these guys are very fortunate that, he did have that background, that upbringing and training. And I think it helped them get through a very difficult situation.
Right. What I thought was impressive, like he didn't wait around for someone to tell him to do that. He just did it. Like he saw a problem and he just like, all right, I need to show these guys how to shoot. And we're going to train for that now.
Exactly. I mean, there was, it was funny that, some of the stories I've heard, and I've been fortunate to interview guys who served with him in his unit, and they're basically all gone now, except there's one sort of lone survivor left. And from what, this gentleman told me, Lieutenant Colonel Calgill, John Calgill is his name, Dias didn't believe in sitting around. He was obviously a junior officer, so he knew how to take and fulfill orders, but he was very proactive.
All right. So Dias in the Philippines, because he's there, he had the opportunity to take part in America's first amphibious battle of World War II. So tell us about that battle.
February 2nd, 1942, the Battle of Aglolima Bay on the west coast of the Philippines, the Bataan Peninsula. Very, very extraordinary circumstances, but, trying times, bring out the best in extraordinary people. And Dias was there at the right time, the right place, and the right moment in history. It's really hard to describe how a fighter pilot ended up leading America's first amphibious landing of the war. He had demonstrated such proficiency as an infantry leader, as a ground pounder, as a real true warrior, instead of just being a flyboy, that the high command, they figured that there was only one guy who could successfully pull off this mission. And Dias, he jumped at the opportunity.
Yeah, there's this line you describe in this document you'd prepared for the Texas Medal of Honor. You talk about the men were just, they were in a dire situation. It was a tough battle. And then Dias is able to rally his men. I loved what he said. Can you talk about how did Dias rally his men who were just kind of, they were sitting still out of fear, basically?
Right. Yeah. He was, at the time, and to give you a little bit of background, the Japanese intended to conquer the Philippines in 45 days. That was their timetable, their schedule, because they wanted to get south, the very oil rich resources, the Dutch East Indies, break through that barrier and cut off the Allied supply chain to Hawaii and to the West Coast. They wanted to get down to Australia, but they needed to conquer the Philippines and do it quickly. And they got kind of desperate. So they tried basically an end run on Bataan, landing 2,000 troops in hopes that they could, get behind our lines and sow chaos in the rear echelon and bring this campaign to a conclusion. But fortunately, these airmen, Dias, the 21st Pursuit Squadron, a lot of shipless sailors and, a similar kind of a hard scrabble ragtag outfit stopped these guys in the jungles And then, you know, when the landing took place, is because there were a few of these Japanese soldiers left. As you studied the war, you know that the fanaticism of the average Japanese soldier was basically unmatched by any other combatants during the war. So there was a handful of these guys that refused to surrender. But unlike, you know, the History Channel documentaries and all the old newsreel footage, you know, these guys didn't have flamethrowers. They couldn't call in airstrikes. They didn't have any ships to bombard these guys offshore who had, you know, fortified themselves in these caves and these little redoubts, you know, on the coast there. So we had to make an amphibious landing, and that's where Dias came in. You know, he organized and planned the whole mission from start to finish, handpicked the guys from his unit, guys who were, you know, the crack shooters in the outfit, guys he knew were tested under fire and they wouldn't crumble or wilt. But this was a new thing. I guess it was one thing to be able to ask these guys, you know, these airmen, these pilots and mechanics to fight in the jungle. It's another thing to ask them to charge up on a beach, you know, in terms of enemy fire. So a lot of them did freeze, and, you know, partially fear, partially you have no training to fall back on. But in that Dias, he was the first one up on the beach. He's firing a Lewis machine gun, you know, basically from the hip, almost, you know, a Hollywood type, you know, cowboy story. So Dias is up on the beach there. You know, Japanese planes are shooting at him, you know, dropping fragmentation bombs, plus these entrenched soldiers, you know, that are hugging the shoreline there in their little rocky caves, they're firing at him. So he's basically trying to, you know, handle this entire situation and get these guys to join him on the beach, so he's not the only one fighting this, making a one-man landing. I guess the best way you could describe it was he shamed them into being men, into doing their duty. And they all kind of snapped out of their funk and they joined him. And battle made a successful conclusion and ended up stopping the Japanese threat. Long story short, you know, the Japanese planned on taking the Philippines in 45 days. It took them 120.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he said like, come on, men, aren't you men? I mean, like that description, it sounds like from a John Wayne movie, you know, World War II movie. It's like textbook.
Exactly. It's like Sands of Iwo Jima. You know, it's an old black and white. You know, you can imagine him there, you know, exhorting these guys to do their duty. And he was basically, you know, calling out the manhood of these guys. You know, you'd rather almost get shot, maimed, wounded, killed than appear to be a coward. These guys, they looked after and they looked up to Dias. And I think they wanted to emulate him, you know, in that regard. He was, you know, he was a leader, but he was, you know, he was a man among men, not just, you know, in the air or on the, you know, on the ground, but in pretty much everything he did. So, you know, they didn't want to let him down. And I think that was a big part of it as well. I mean, they liked him so much. And, you know, again, it wasn't a fear thing. It wasn't a disciplinary thing. I mean, it was, you know, they wanted to prove they were men, but they also wanted to be accepted by Ed Dias, by their commanding officer. And again, you know, this wonderful, you know, warrior, but a great human being who they looked up to and aspired to.
So what was the outcome of that battle? Did they win?
Yes, they completely wiped out, you know, all the Japanese on the beachhead with only actually one casualty, which out of 20 some men is unbelievable. Sometimes you can confuse bravery and glory, you know, and all those things. And like I said, you know, rushing into the battle, you know, with little regard for your own personal safety. But Dias, he wanted to bring his guys home as well. I think he did think of them as a family. So he was not just a commanding officer and a friend. He was also kind of a father figure, even though he was only, in some cases, a few years, you know, older than these guys. I think he thought that, hey, Uncle Sam trusted me with their lives, and I want to do my best to get them, you know, home to their loved ones and their families. You know, he wasn't always playing Rambo. Let's just say that he was, you know, he was trying to save lives as well.
So what happened to Dias and his unit after the Battle of Agaloma Bay?
Well, after the successful landing and the conclusion, that was the climax of the Battle of the Points. And, you know, medals were handed out. Dias, the other pilot with him, received the Distinguished Service Cross, which is the second highest medal for valor you can receive in the U.S. military. The enlisted men all received Silver Stars. But for Dias, the bigger reward was he was returned to flight duty. We, you know, had managed to cobble together a handful of planes. And so he was basically put in charge of all air operations on Bataan, and which was running what was called the Bamboo Fleet. It was a small number of aircraft. A lot of them were unarmed, basically sort of training planes. So he started figuring out, okay, you know, what can I do with this small handful of planes? How can I, again, be on the giving part of it instead of taking it? So he was returned to flight duty and started putting together more targets for the Japanese.
But he eventually gets taken prisoner at Bantan. So like, how'd that happen?
That's another part of, you know, sort of Dias's myth. His legend is that he was ordered, you know, to evacuate the Philippines. Obviously, you know, high command saw that the battle was going south. Obviously, you know, as a skilled squadron leader, pretty valuable to the war effort. They wanted him out of there. And you think about it, pilots don't do very, can't really help their country behind barbed wire. So they wanted to evacuate Dias. But again, Dias, you know, his responsibility to his men, his sort of definition of leadership required him to stay. He wasn't going to run out on these guys. And I think he felt as though anybody who tried to get off, you know, the baton was, you know, lacking in their duty or their sense of manhood. So he sent out basically everybody in his place, which is, you know, again, the way he was, very unselfish and very, the best way you could say it is, you know, he did care about others more than he cared about himself. That's how he ended up becoming stuck on Bataan and had the misfortune of being in the infamous Bataan Death March.
And how did he fare during the Bataan Death March?
Well, the Death March was actually, you know, as bad as you can imagine, as it's been portrayed in history through books and stories of that nature. Dias had it a little bit worse just because he was taller than the average GI. You know, blue eyes, blonde hair, that type of thing. So it made him a target. And plus he was an officer. So he was a pretty big target for abuse from the Japanese. He took it in stride, literally and figuratively. I think he understood that if he could deflect some of the blows from his men, from wounded guys, that was no question. He would do that. Again, the guy never, ever gave up anything he ever did in his life.
So I'm curious, it sounds like he continued his leadership, natural leadership role even during the march.
Definitely. You know, the line that he uttered was, he said, you know, we were surrendered, but we didn't feel licked. I think there was a sense of, you know, that these guys didn't lay down their arms out of any type of cowardice or fear. They were, you know, they were ordered to. And so he, you know, even though he was no longer a warrior, he was a prisoner. I think he took the same mentality as he did in combat. Again, whether he was in a cockpit or out in the jungle, to survival. And, you know, he sort of transformed from, you know, that mindset to being a survivor instead of a prisoner.
So where did the march go to? What prison camp did he go to?
Well, the march was actually the Bataan Death March. It's, you know, it's one of those confusing things where you think it's just one endless line of prisoners. It was more or less a series of marches, you know, by different numbers of prisoners, and, you know, which the Japanese had collected in various groups, and they would move out in specific days. And it, from start to finish, the march took about 60 miles north into Luzon out of Bataan. And depending where you were on the road, where you were on Bataan when you surrendered, you know, these guys started trickling into the first prison camp anywhere from 3 days to 3 weeks after the surrender. And that first prison camp for all the men captured on Bataan was called Camp O'Donnell. And like I said, it was, you know, heading up into the plains of Luzon out of Bataan.
Gotcha. So how did so he makes the break. So this is going back. So his G.I. Joe status, like he escapes from the camp. Like how did he pull that off? Because not many people, I don't think, was he the only one to escape from a prisoner camp in the Pacific?
Yeah, well, he wasn't the only. I mean, there were a few other individuals, you know, who broke out of different camps. And this is throughout the Pacific, throughout the Far East, you know, the Asian mainland, China, places like that. But he moved from Camp O'Donnell to Cabana Chuan, which was basically the largest holding center the Japanese had of American prisoners in the Pacific, again, outside of Manila, plains of Luzon. But he was actually transferred to Davao, which was called the Davao Penal Colony, outside the city of Davao on the island of Mindanao, which is the southernmost island of the Philippines, about 600 miles south of Manila. And the reason he was sent there, along with, he was in a group of about 2,000 prisoners that were herded onto this merchant ship, crowded together like cattle, pretty much, because the Japanese needed prisoners to work the penal colony. And that was basically a pre-war prison in the Philippine Commonwealth that was designed to be escape-proof. It was for all the worst criminals in the Philippines, all the murderers, rapists. It was kind of like their Alcatraz or, you know, their Devil's Island. But it was also a plantation. And so the Japanese got this bright idea. Well, you know, we have all these thousands of American prisoners of war. Let's put them to work, you know, for the greater good of the Japanese empire and to help the war effort. And so Dias was one of those individuals selected to go there. Again, you know, never say die, his can-do attitude. To the Japanese, that camp was escape-proof. That was, you know, that no one had ever broken out of there, you know, in its 10-year existence. But to Ed Dias, there was no such thing as an escape-proof prison camp or a mission that couldn't be accomplished.
So he escapes. Did he escape with other people as well, other men?
Yes, it was a group of 10. 10 Americans, 2 Filipinos. The 2 Filipinos were convicts who had been incarcerated there at the war, both for murder, and they signed on as guides. 10 Americans, it was basically an all-service team, kind of an all-star team of, you know, Dias was an Air Corps guy, his wingman, Sam Gracio, his head mechanic on baton, Lieutenant Leo Bolins, plus 3 Marines, Captain Austin Schaffner, who was a manly man, if there ever was one, football player from the University of Tennessee. He was a ranking Marine officer. And there were two lieutenants, great friends of his, Jack Hawkins and Mike Dobrovich, and 3 Army personnel, a Coast Artillery officer who fought on Corregidor, plus 2 enlisted men. Steve Melnick was the officer, Major Melnick, and then Sergeants Bob Spielman and Paul Marshall. And the ranking officer was a Navy commander by the name of Melvin McCoy, who was one of those living geniuses. He graduated from the Naval Academy with, the way I understand it, still has the highest ranking in mathematics in the Academy's history. So you have guys from basically every branch of the service, every part of the country. And Dias, again, used his team building skills to select this group, this all-star team of escape artists to accomplish this mission.
And what happened? Like, how did they make it back to the Allies? I mean, that's, you know, escaping is one thing. It's, you know, evading, that's often the hard part.
Well, this is usually the part of the interviews where I say, well, buy the book or watch the documentary.
Right.
to not, you know, give away the entire story. It's a fascinating, story of how these guys got out. Basically, they walked out the front door. They outsmarted the Japanese. But then again, you know, as one of the men, Bob Spielman, said, you know, there's no use in escaping if you're just going to go hide under a rock somewhere. Right. You have to, you know, you have to do it for a reason. They had a reason. They wanted to break the news of the death march and the atrocities that the Japanese were committing against the prisoners of war, you know, to their government, to the rest of the world. So that, you know, they had the motive. They figured out the means. And basically, you know, met up with friendly Filipinos and figured out that, you know, there was a resistance movement that had formed after the surrender. And there were a lot of guys who, you know, who didn't give up and a lot of, you know, local. It was basically a Filipino army led by, you know, a few American officers that had managed to stay out of these prison camps. And they had coordinated with General MacArthur's headquarters in Australia, and they were receiving, you know, supplies. Sounds, you know, sort of trite to say it, but he basically flagged down a ride with a submarine. Right. You know, and that's how he reached friendly forces. You know, it was him and 2 other individuals, Lieutenant Commander McCoy and Major Melnick, who were the first 3 to get out of the Philippines to meet with MacArthur in Australia, and they were the first ones to bring out the word of what was going on in the occupied Philippines behind Japan's bamboo curtain, so to speak. They were the first to bring out the news of the death march and the atrocities and, you know, what was going on in these prison camps.
But here's where things get kind of crazy, because you figure they're telling the government officials about the Bantan death march and what the Japanese are doing. But like, the government says, okay, thanks, but like, don't tell anybody. Like, what was going on there? Why didn't the government want these guys to talk publicly about what was going on in the Philippines?
Exactly. You know, it's remarkable because, again, you know, you're looking back and, you know, and it's historical hindsight, hindsight's 2020, and you think of, boy, you know, these guys just pulled off probably, I mean, the greatest escape of World War II. I mean, I think it, you know, I think Hollywood gives all the credit to the guys in Europe, you know, that Steve McQueen movie, you know, the Great Escape in Europe. But what these guys did, I mean, they pulled off something that was impossible. You know, they escaped from an escape-proof prison camp, stuck in the middle of this giant swamp, alligators and headhunters and all these things, you know, got off an island surrounded by the Japanese Navy, somehow got to friendly forces. And so you think that would probably be worthy of a ticker tape parade. But the government thought differently. And again, it goes back to what we discussed a few minutes ago. The Europe First policy was the order of the day strategically. And the United States government, keep in mind, the time period of the war that this happened was kind of a gray area, you know, of the war, 1943, middle part of the war. You know, we had gotten past Pearl Harbor, you know, the dark early days where there was nothing but, you know, a succession of bitter losses, you know, to turning the tide in Midway, Guadalcanal, you know, so we had the Japanese basically kind of holding them at bay. We had, you know, reached a stalemate with them to a certain extent. But in Europe, the invasion of Europe was being planned. So, you know, late 1943, you're looking at D-Day in June of 44. And, you know, the government didn't want to upset the strategic apple cart with the invasion of Europe and everything that had to go into planning that in terms of, you know, keeping all these disparate allies, Britain, France, Free French, and, you know, and all these other countries, you know, on board with the plan that they, you know, they didn't want to disrupt planning for that, jeopardize it, because they knew that, you know, if the American people heard what was going on, you know, what the Japanese were doing to their prisoners of war, it would have created such a dramatic outcry for revenge. A lot of people would have begged the question, wait a minute, Japan attacked us. They snuck attack us at Pearl Harbor. Why are we putting them on the back burner? Why are we concentrating on Hitler and Germany first? If you find out your guys are being beheaded and tortured and treated in all these despicable ways, I think that the American public would have, you know, there would have been a vociferous outcry to make a Pacific first policy instead. So when Dias and these guys, you know, first came home, there were no ticker tape parades and there was no heroes homecoming. They were told to shut up and keep quiet.
But eventually the government released the story and that caused, like, it happened exactly what they thought would happen. The public was just like, no, we got to do something about this.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, and it, again, it's, I get into this in much, much greater detail, you know, in my documentary you know, on Colonel Dias is, there's not just, you know, we may think now, you know, I think there's a lot of, you know, low approval ratings for all of our politicians, but there's, you know, there weren't any idiots working in the government back then. They figured out, well, hey, we need to harness, you know, this anger and this outrage. And they did it by basically sort of controlling the flow of the story when it was released to coincide with war bond sales. And, you know, basically sort of creating a spark. This was a period of the war where a lot of people aren't familiar with. Again, kind of right smack in the middle of things between these, you know, more well-known historical events. And not a lot of people are aware that the war did drag on for 4 years, and it wasn't a, you know, concerted, high output, high emotional feeling situation for the duration of those 4 years. I think there was, you know, the initial you know, outrage over Pearl Harbor. And then, you know, again, we had, you know, some tide turning victories, but the things had sort of stagnated at this time. You know, people were kind of taking it easy. We weren't being threatened with invasion on the West Coast anymore. You know, Hitler had been turned back in Russia, and, you know, things were going in a better direction. I think people started getting a little complacent. War plant industries, people were taking days off. You know, they had problems with, you know, hiring and output. People weren't buying bonds for the war. I think everyone was kind of just getting tired of, you know, the endless slog of this fight. But this story, the government expertly turned it around as a pretty much an ingenious propaganda move to light a fire under everybody.
What happened to Dies after this? Did he go back to, after he went back to America and back to the Allies, did he get back into battle, or what did he have? Did the government have other plans for him?
You know, it's, we talk about this, you know, G.I. Joe and Captain America, you know, and he is this almost this great Hollywood built or, you know, Hollywood dreamed up hero, but there isn't a happy ending, unfortunately. He was preparing. He was going to get back in a cockpit. He was going to take command of a squadron that was heading over to Europe, flying P-38 Lightnings, which was at the time one of, you know, the fastest, most heavily armed fighters that, you know, we had during the war, and one of the most, you know, fearsome in terms of, you know, the way the enemy regarded it, you know, in both theaters. And so he was preparing to do that. Fortunately, he suffered a tragic plane crash over Los Angeles, Burbank, you know, and it's really, I mean, again, tragic, but, you know, you think about all the things that this guy went through, you know, survived aerial combat, ground combat, leading the first amphibious landing of the war, nearly a full year as, you know, a prisoner of the Japanese after the infamous Bataan Death March, escaping from a prison camp. He's being on the run for several months and, you know, and surviving the jungle and all those things, to die in a, you know, in a freak plane crash. It almost, it defies convention.
No, yeah, it reminded me of how Patton died, right? Like he died in a car crash after doing all this stuff in Europe. And his last words were, "This is a hell of a way to die."
You know, it's amazing. It really was. I mean, you think about that again, but, and, you know, plus Patton's life. I mean, if you look back, bigger picture, you know, he was wounded in World War One, you know, and all the adventures he had, and, you know, in terms of being, you know, being a great horseback rider and everything else. You think about all the things that these guys went through. And MacArthur was another one. He'd been shot at everywhere, you know, for close to 30 years in his military career, and was always, you know, very daring and brave, you know, to sort of escape fate, you know, so many times. I guess maybe Dye just sort of, you know, was so much of a man, he just kind of ran out of luck, or ran out of his nine lives, I guess you could say.
Right. So he's 27 at this time, so still, you know, young man. So as you said, he did all this stuff. You kind of went through what he did in two short years. You hear this like, man, this guy should win the Medal of Honor or be awarded. Did that happen to him?
No, that's you know, it's again another tragic aspect that made it sort of a sad ending instead of a happy ending. He had several opportunities where he could have been awarded the Medal of Honor. Again, there were things that happened over in the Philippines, obviously, in terms of loss of records and, you know, being a part of a losing battle. You know, things were, you know, things didn't go the right way or break for him. And, you know, you need people to recommend you, and all the paperwork has to be in order. And that was, again, you know, it's a loss. So you're burning documents and records and things like that. So, you know, he was unfortunate in that regard. He was also, I think he was recommended for it for his last heroic act, which was, he died in that plane crash, but he saved the life of an innocent bystander, you know, a motorist who had strayed in his landing path. You know, Dias could have saved his own life and probably crashed into this car on a street in Burbank, but he decided to try to, you know, save the life of this, you know, unknown motorist, and, you know, in that regard, lost his. He was recommended for the Medal of Honor, but the motion was denied, and he received the Soldier's Medal, which is a very prestigious award, but it's for action, you know, not involving heroic action, not involving an armed enemy. And, you know, it took place on American soil. So, but I guess, you know, in terms of talking about a happy ending, I'm leading a movement, so to speak, to have Dias recommended and reconsidered for the Medal of Honor. And hopefully we can rectify this past wrong, which a lot of things happen according to fate and things out of his control. But I think there was also some resistance from, you know, members of the President Roosevelt's administration and other people. So it was semi-political. Again, Dias was the, you know, kind of a survivor of the Alamo who shows up and wants to tell his story at a particularly bad moment, you know, in time. So he was, you know, kept quiet and, you know, kind of pinned down by government forces, his own government forces in that regard. But, you know, hopefully we can rectify this situation and get him the medal he deserves.
So, I mean, I love to take, there's so many lessons we can get from this guy, but the thing that stands out the most as I read about Ed's story was just his ability to inspire men and his leadership under fire. I mean, was that natural? Like, was that something he was just born with, or did he consciously develop that? Do we know that? Or this is just, he was just born with it.
I think it's a little bit of both, to be honest with you. Right. I mean, if you look at, again, I think the innate part of it, he was born with, you know, the way to sort of carry himself, the way to, you know, to appear before others and to, and, you know, inspire people. I think he just had that natural personality where he could, you know, he could get people together. He was a team builder. You know, he was someone who was a very inspirational, motivational type figure. But if you remember a small line I mentioned earlier when describing Dias's background, his upbringing, his personality, he was a hell of an actor. He was always in school theatrical productions. And even once he joined the Air Corps, he still in his spare time acted in local theater communities in Shreveport and at Barksdale Air Force Base, Hamilton Field out in San Francisco. So he kept up his acting skills in that regard. So I think he was also sort of aware of how he carried himself and how he could appear. And, you know, he could put on a good show. Let's just say that. I think if you add all those things up together and in some, that's what made him, you know, a great leader. But it wasn't an act. It truly was him.
Yeah. Well, John, this has been a great conversation. Where can people go to learn more about the book? Or not the book, it's the documentary.
Right. Well, the documentary focuses on specifically on Ed Dias's exploits and, you know, and his, you know, his, the way he, you know, the way he led people, the way he, you know, conducted his war, that brief 2-year period that you mentioned. The book covers the escape and, you know, adds in the other characters, you know, on a sort of a bigger picture. 450 page book, and then you have an hour documentary. Sometimes the documentary is a little bit easier for a lot of people, you know, in a busy world to digest. You can go to 4-4-43.com. That's the name of the film, 4443. And you can sign the Medal of Honor petition that we have for Colonel Dias. We're nearing almost 30,000 signatures right now. And so we're going to be getting that out there and sent to the folks in Washington with a lot of other materials, you know, for this Medal of Honor request. So, you know, all your listeners out there, if you can sign up for that, we'd really appreciate it. You know, add your name to the list, join the mission, so to speak. And also the film, the documentary, again, it's an hour long. It was a official selection of the GI Film Festival in Washington. And you can purchase DVDs there on the same website, 4-4-43.com. And, you know, all the proceeds go towards helping our, you know, this mission to get Dias recognized and to get him the award that he deserves and frankly that he earned.
Well, John Lucas, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Brett, hey, pleasure was all mine. Thank you. Thank you very, very much for helping me share this story. Really appreciate it.
My guest today was John Lucas. He's the author of the book Escape from Davao, as well as the filmmaker of the documentary 4443. You find out more information about the film at 4-4-43. You also can buy it there. And you also find out more information about John's mission to get Ed Dias the Medal of Honor there as well. You can also check out our show notes at aom.is/Dias. That's DYESS, where you find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. If you enjoy the show, if you've gotten something out of it, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. As always, thank you for your continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.